All right, thank you, everybody. It is definitely a pleasure to be here. You know, it's funny, I was telling Frank I was going to tell a story on him. When we had the 2020 conference, we were right at the beginning of COVID, right? So we had the conference, and then we all went home, and then, you know, everything started. And then last year, we had that little respite, remember, and things looked good, and so we all got out here last year. And so this contiguous year, and I have to admit, when Frank did the talk in 2020 about where he thought and predicted COVID was going to go, I was absolutely amazed that he was so accurate in knowing what was going to happen. I literally went back and listened to his talk from here about 9 months later and figured out why it was he knew the course of that pandemic. And it was while we were doing our post-conference roundup, which this year was in Orlando at Universal Studios. We always pick cool places to get together. And he revealed that he had been on the national disaster team. And well, I don't know, what was the name of the team that you were on, that where you guys got together and talked about if a pandemic broke out? Anyways, pandemic planning. They had a whole committee on it. And he had literally predicted it. So today we'll be talking about antibiotic technology or biomarker technology and antibiotic stewardship, the role of procalcitonin. These are a little bit of housekeeping. This is normally an hour lecture, but we're going to keep it on time to a half an hour. Here are my disclosures back here. So what are the objectives? We're going to talk about how obtaining procalcitonin levels early in the disease process adds to the continuum of care. List the times to obtain measurements to evaluate effectiveness of antibiotic therapy when we see the levels of procalcitonin, which we usually check daily. You don't need to check it more often than that. And then sometimes every other day, depending on who is writing the orders. We'll talk about monitoring and how to utilize it in our day-to-day utilization. And then treatment. whether to use antibiotics or not use antibiotics, which is so important. You know, when I had these COPDers come in and they say, man, I can't breathe. And I ask them, do you feel like this is bad enough to be in the hospital, or how do you feel? And a lot of times they know themselves pretty well. If you've been doing emergency medicine long enough, you know that they usually know when they need to be admitted to the hospital. Can't hear me as well?
I don't think your loud mic is switched on, Jim. Sorry.
Sorry. I thought it was.
It was.
Oh, now we got it. So I'll ask the COPDers, I'll say, do you feel like you need to be in the hospital? A lot of times they know, right? And I'll say, what is it we normally do for you when you are in the hospital if they say they need to be in? And they'll say, well, you know, they always give me steroids. They always give me nebulized breathing treatments, antibiotics, and that one pain medicine that starts with a D. Dilantin? Dilala? Something like that. And one of the great things in utilizing this test has been that I've been able to look at a procalcitonin level, and not everybody that gets put in the hospital for COPD that doesn't have any of the other clinical markers that we always use to increase sputum and those kind of things, I can tell them with a great amount of confidence, hey, you don't need antibiotics, and you certainly don't need any Dilantin. So let's start out with a case study. This is about 5 BC. 5 years ago, before COVID. Does anybody remember before COVID? Can I see any hands? Yes. Okay, there are still some memories left. This is a 90-year-old female. She came in the emergency department. She had been admitted about 2 weeks before that with bronchitis, and now she's back with a cough. Those are her vital signs. She's a little hypoxic. As you can see, she's 89% on room air, which is probably already tipping me to believe that she's going to need to be admitted. We get a chest x-ray, and she's got a pneumonia on that. So I have to admit, this was in my early days of procalcitonin. Didn't have a lot of experience with it. Drew the procalcitonin. It was pretty low, but I still thought, you know, this is a bounce-back pneumonia, hospital-acquired pneumonia. So I went ahead, started the antibiotics, put her in the hospital. And our hospitalist team, I don't know if Dr. Miller was there at the time, but he probably was around, ordered a procalcitonin on day three, and then day four as well. And what happened was she popped RSV positive, I think, on day three. Antibiotics were stopped, and they just treated her for a viral pneumonia. 2 weeks later, I actually looked in her chart, and she had had a CT ordered in follow-up. Do we wonder why healthcare costs so much, Richard? Is, you know, we couldn't just do a chest x-ray to see if her pneumonia was resolved? But anyway, so she gets a CT scan. The pneumonia is gone, and clinically, she's doing great. So this is just an example of kind of, for me at least, the beginning of utilizing procalcitonin in my day-to-day practice. Level was low, but I still didn't want to just rely on the test itself. I think if I seen this, or if I saw this patient this week, I would probably not start antibiotics on her. So it's kind of a test that I think kind of that grows on us. When do I use it? I use it when patients come in short of breath. If I have the concern that they may have a lower respiratory tract infection, then I get it drawn. A lot of us, we now have a doc in triage. We'll utilize this test in triage on the patients that we're looking at out there. And I'll tell you some, if I have enough time, I'll tell you a great story of utilizing this and sending somebody home. So why do we need it? Well, shortness of breath has a differential diagnosis. As you all know, it's a mile long, CHF, MI, pericarditis, valvular disease, cardiomyopathy, COPD, asthma, bronchitis, pneumonia, airway obstruction, PE, anemia. This is not an exhaustive list, but we could certainly become exhausted in all the different reasons why people can be short of breath and admit and come to the emergency department. And that's where this test has really been of great utilization to me and my colleagues in determining what is the reason that they're so short of breath. There are some caveats. There are some instances where patients will have an elevated procalcitonin in the absence of a bacterial infection. And in some of those cases, such as severe trauma, renal failure, abdominal surgeries, these are usually pretty quick peaks, and they don't get in the way for very long, but they can be reasons that people can have elevated procalcitonin in the absence of a bacterial infection. Gut translocation is thought to be the reason. There's a couple of cancers, medullary or C-cell cancers of the thyroid or small cell carcinomas of the lung. A lot of times we already know that those are present, so they tend not to get in the way. So why do we need another marker? When we look at white blood cells, and it's a simple, inexpensive test, but there's about 600 reasons why white blood cell counts can be elevated, right? From anybody taking steroids to a trauma or whatever. So it can definitely find inflammation, but it doesn't tell us whether that inflammation is secondary to a bacterial infection. C-reactive protein, same kind of thing. Lactate doesn't help us determine at all in many cases whether somebody has a bacterial versus a viral infection, because as we've all seen, you can get just as sick from a viral pneumonia as you can from any type of bacterial pneumonia, and adding antibiotics in there is not a great idea. So when we look at the specificity for procalcitonin, it's about 94%. When it's negative, we don't have a bacterial infection. The positive predictive value is when it's elevated, we're more concerned about sepsis. How does it work? This green cartoon is the bacteria that attaches to a toll-like receptor on the cell, which then starts a cascade where we'll see interleukins and TNF and all many of these other markers increase, but there's a lot of drugs or a lot of disease processes that will block that. So those aren't always great markers. So what we have is procalcitonin that, again, when that stimulus occurs, that bacteria binds to the cell, we'll see a procalcitonin transcription and then release the procalcitonin into the lung. All right, I love this case because it was my first real COVID patient. So this was after I came back from the conference here 2 years ago, and I see this guy come in to see me. He's a 50-year-old truck driver, pretty healthy guy, hepatic steatosis, depression, tendonitis, no real meds, not a smoker, and he's got a fever and a cough. He's been sick for about 2 weeks. His doctor had put him on doxycycline about a week before that, didn't get any better. Put him on Tamiflu after that, oseltamivir, and that was on Friday, and he came in to see me on Monday morning. And as you can see by his vital signs, he's a little bit sick, 102 temp, heart rate's a little quick, breathing rapidly. Although, frankly, as I, you know, when I talk to residents and I go, is this a person that you'd sit next to on a bus? How sick do they look? Like, you know, you get on a bus and you see somebody and you go, I think I'll go sit in the back, even if there's three other people in that seat. And this wasn't a guy that I probably would not have sat next to on a bus, but he still, you know, his vital signs were there. Because he was a truck driver, I did a CT scan, thinking maybe this is a pulmonary embolism, and I saw the scan. It was, again, this is the beginning of COVID. I looked at this and I'm like, oh my gosh, this guy's in ARDS. He's the best looking patient, though, I've ever had in ARDS. Best looking from the standpoint of he didn't look that ill. Laboratory values, exactly what we would expect with COVID. Procalcitonin was low. Again, we were at the beginning of this, and I called my hospitalist friend, Jen Nye, and I said, hey, Jen, should I'm thinking maybe we should start something here. She goes, hold on, let's wait, let's put him in the hospital, let's see how he does. Kudos to Gen 9. On day 3, they rechecked his procalcitonin. And remember, this is before we had rapid tests. His test is positive. They text me that night and say, hey, your guy's got COVID. So I'm watching TV, and I'm like, oh, my goodness. He ends up in the CCU on 3 pressors, and they had to keep him prone. He also got, this was funny, because this is the beginning, right? Chloroquine alone, remember that? He got that and 1 dose of azithromycin, or 1 dose of chloroquine, and a dose of Azithromax from ID. And then he's prone, 8 days on a ventilator, and we kept checking procalcitonin levels, because had they been up, we would have been more concerned about him, because the level is proportional to the bacterial burden. Doesn't reveal the location, but it can tell us whether antibiotics are working or not. His procalcitonin level stayed low. And when we take a look at, and he ended up doing very well as an outpatient, after his 8 days prone. As a matter of fact, I've stayed in touch with him. His son is now one of my research assistants, and the patient is doing very, very well. So why do we use this? Well, if you look at procalcitonin, the area under the curve shows that negative predictive value, 90%, positive predictive value, about 94%. And again, I use it because I want to know, is this somebody I want to start antibiotics on? Or is this somebody that I'm concerned about is going to get septic? And what we can see is that if it's less than 0.5, the risk of becoming septic is very low, right? And so when we have these patients, and I'm the triage doc, and I'll tell this story now. I had a 73-year-old female that came in, and she was hypoxic, and she was COVID positive, and she did not want to stay in the hospital. Her pulse ox was like 82 or 83%. And I'm like, I've never sent a patient, a 73-year-old lady with pneumonia home with hypoxia in my career. And I know I look incredibly young. Not that young, all right, trained at Hopkins, graduated in 98. But anyways, she was with it, though. Her granddaughter said, yeah, send her home. I'll keep an eye on her. We sent her to our COVID clinic the next morning. She got monoclonal antibodies, and I called her on day 3. She was doing great. Talked to her granddaughter. How's she doing? Well, her number's still low when she walks to the bathroom. I said, oh, my gosh. But how's she doing otherwise? She goes, oh, she's got a great appetite. She's in a great mood. Did wonderfully. And her procalcitonin was low. I don't think I would have ever sent her home if her procalcitonin level had not been so low. But her likelihood of progressing to sepsis was low. Once it starts to get above 2 procalcitonin level, very indicative of that we have a patient that could be on their way to getting septic. How do we use this number? It starts to go up after about 3 hours. So if we have somebody that drives by the emergency department and coughs and comes in, they may not have been sick long enough to mount a very significant procalcitonin level. That's not our usual patient. What we do see is that it goes up in about 3 to 6 hours, peaks at about 12 to 24 hours. And so if we see a value of 10, and we put somebody in the hospital, and the next day it's gone down to 5, we can say our antibiotics are working. All right. Here's some measurements over time. Just as an example, if we see somebody that comes in and their levels are low, then we can be very confident in, with the right clinical picture that they don't have a bacterial infection. If we started antibiotics, we can stop them at that point. If it goes from 5 to then down to 2.5, if we've had them in the hospital, looks like they have a bacterial pneumonia, and we see it come down from a 5 to a 2.5 to 1.25, and then gets less than 80% of its initial starting value, we can stop the antibiotics, and because we can say that they're working. And you can discretionately, if you want to stop the antibiotics, certainly at that point we can. If we see the number going up, and this is something that we looked at our shop, was anybody that had vancomycin ordered at our hospital automatically had a procalcitonin level drawn to, and then had daily procalcitonin levels. And those were followed by our pharmacists, our pharmacy team, the antibiotic stewardship committee. And it was really great because they would call the practitioners and say, hey, listen, procalcitonin was low yesterday, it's low again today, would you like to stop the vancomycin? And then we followed those 52 patients and we looked at how many of them needed vancomycin restarted, how many of them ended up in the hospital again because they were sent home, and then how many of them died. And after adjudication, we didn't see anybody that we stopped that needed a restart or that died directly because of stopping the vancomycin. What we did see, which was interesting, is the pharmacist told me, he said, you know vancomycin cures cancer. I said, what do you mean by that, Stefan? And he said, well, it seems like every time somebody with cancer comes in with a fever, you guys always start vancomycin on it. Do you think that that's why, you know, the vancomycin cures cancer? I didn't think he was very funny. I told him to stay in his lane. Nonetheless, we did not think any of the cancer patients that were started on vanc and had their vanc stopped actually died because of that. Most of them were in hospice. But it's very nice to be able to follow and see if we can utilize the procalcitonin to either increase or stop antibiotics. This is a study that was done by Dr. Self. It was about 1,000 patients, and they took a look at what was the procalcitonin level in viral pneumonia. And as you can see, it's pretty low. 0.09 was the average. Atypical bacteria, like a mycoplasm, something like that, 0.2. And you may say, well, that doesn't sound like that much of a difference, but actually it does reach significant p-values of 0.05. And then the typical pneumonias, the ones that we're most afraid of, the streptococcal pneumonias, which are not the, it's the most commonly diagnosed bacterial pneumonia, but not the most common pneumonia anymore. And what we see is that the procalcitonin levels with that are about 2.5. Which, I don't know, this pointer is really weak. Can you see that from back there? Just nod like you are still paying attention, if you can stay awake after all the good skiing today. But as you can see, that's a huge difference between the viral pneumonias versus the typical bacterial pneumonias. So when do we start? If they're less than 0.1, we don't start antibiotics. If it's 0.1 to 0.25, again, antibiotics are discouraged. 0.26 to 0.5, that's where we really start to look at patients with a lower respiratory tract infection, the right clinical picture. They're not maybe somebody that has chronic renal disease where they're not going to clear procalcitonin quite as much. Those are the patients that, frankly, I'm much more willing to start antibiotics on. 0.5, strongly encouraged. And that's where when I see these, I gave this talk at the Arizona ASAP, which was in Tucson in August. I don't know how anybody ever talked me into going to Tucson in August. If they ever give you that opportunity, it was 107 degrees. I don't care if they call that dry heat, wet heat. 107 is hot as hot, right? And so somebody asked me, she said, well, what if I get this COVID patient? They don't really look too bad, but their procal is about 0.6. And what would you do with that patient? I said, I'm much more likely to put that kind of patient in the hospital or make sure that I get them seen the next day, right? Or I'm more likely to start somebody like that on antibiotics. So when I see somebody above 0.5, I'm certainly more concerned about them. This is from Dr. Gaffin, when they talked about that although Streptococcus pneumonia are the most frequently isolated bacterial pathogens, they are no longer the most common cause of community-acquired pneumonia. In fact, despite extensive testing, no pathogen is detected in 60% of patients with CAP. Does that mean they're all viral? Not necessarily, but it is telling us that more and more of the patients that we're seeing with pneumonia are not necessarily bacterial pneumonias. The shift to viral causes of pneumonia is probably due in part to the pneumococcal conjugate vaccination of children. Is that a question or your arm is up? Okay, good. So how is it possible when we have fewer antibiotics can have better outcomes? I remember looking at this. You look at the duration of antibiotics, you look at all these different things, is one set duration. You know, patients are so different. Bacterial count at onset, we have those people that wait too long to come in, host immune response, source of infection, protected location. Does everybody with pneumonia need 5 days? Some people need 10. Some people might need 14. Every UTI need 3 days. It doesn't make any sense. So the nice thing about procalcitonin guidance is it'll help us decide whether or not we want to use antibiotics. And this was from Dr. Rodriguez, where they looked at ICU co-bacterial infections. And again, for the essence of time, I'm not going to spend a lot of time on the studies, but procalcitonin has a high negative predictive value, 94%, and lower procalcitonin levels seem to be a good tool for excluding co-infection, particularly for patients without shock. So again, this was procalcitonin in viral epidemics, same kind of conclusion was that we can use it in that setting. This came out of Wuhan, which is very interesting. Where do patients with COVID get into the most trouble? Where are those patients that have the non-survivals, non-survivors? And if you see, it's around day, somewhere around 10 to 14, they get that co-bacterial infection and that's where they have a high likelihood of a severe case or of dying. So when I see a patient that comes in, and sometimes I know my nurses get a little bit annoyed, and they'll be like, he's got COVID for a week and a half. Tell him he's going to be short of breath and have a cough. And I go, well, maybe let's not act so quickly, because there's a chance that this patient's coming in because now they're sicker. And for whatever reason, that COVID has made them more predisposed or has predisposed them to a now bacterial infection. And that's where procalcitonin, for me, really becomes a big help. 43-year-old female, this is the third and final case. She's got history of pulmonary hypertension, continuous O2 at home. There, her vitals, 99.5, heart rate of 121. She's already got a little bit of a low blood pressure. This was actually sent to me from a friend at an outside hospital. I'm very grateful that she did that. And her labs, this was she was COVID positive, white count as you would expect. Procalcitonin was low. Lactic acid, not too bad. But unfortunately, this is a lady who has not a lot of reserve and ends up later intubated that day. Day two, she's hypoxic, hypotensive. She spikes the temperature. She's on Levofet at max dose, dobutamine and vasopressin, just to keep a MAC of 65, a MAP of 65. She's getting prone. So around day 14, she's still not doing very well. They check a procalcitonin. It's 3.82. Is that high or low? That's high, right? How many days do you think it's been high? Probably a couple, right? So unfortunately, that window of opportunity was lost. And the question is, had they been checking this at day 8, day 10, day 12, instead of day 14, they may have been able to start. And then unfortunately, she was started on antibiotics and unfortunately expired at day 17. So here's an opportunity lost where we could have, you know, potentially checked her on a more frequent basis. This is COVID-19. The patients that had higher procalcitonin levels were at greater risk of having cases of severe coronavirus. And these were four different cases with a meta-analysis that overall showed the higher the procalcitonin, the more likely they were to have a poor outcome. The economic model takes a look at when we do utilize procalcitonin as part of a protocol. They looked at several different studies and saw that the C. diff infections when the protocol was used with procalcitonin was about $16,000 less than those that did not use procalcitonin. Ventilator, $2,000 less, and the average cost per patient was about $11,000. And I took a look at this the first time. I said, well, how is this that if we're using less antibiotics and more of a protocol, they said, we're more likely to get those diagnoses more rapidly, right? We get that CHFer that comes in, and they've got bilateral infiltrates and a little bit of a cough and a temp of 99.5, and we hit them with some antibiotics. We put them in the hospital, and 3 days later, they're still not better. And then somebody checks a BNP or starts to give them some Lasix. They turn around and do great. So by ruling out the infectious etiologies, we seem to be able to save some money, and that's really where it seems that procalcitonin fits into our armamentarium. So that ends the formal part of a one-hour lecture, now done in 25 minutes. Nonetheless, do you have any questions about that? Yes, absolutely.
What about for meningitis?
Great question. What about meningitis? Our pediatricians are big on this. They love it. I think less than 30 days, we really haven't looked at it, but there's some decent data out of Europe that says between 30 and 90 days, if your procal is not high, we do not stick steel in kids' backs. And we've actually used it in our shop and find it to be very helpful. And with adults, the same kind of thing. I've had patients come in with meningitis. Their taps were positive, but their procals were low, and they just kind of looked like a viral meningitis, right? And did not do the antibiotics. So I find it to be very helpful in that setting. And change of mental status patients, too. You know, I get somebody that comes in, and I'm worried, you know, could this be an encephalopathy? So I use it often in that setting. Dr. Oak, no way. Yeah, for sure.
Thank you very much.
Thanks.
So I don't believe procalcitonin is FDA approved for differentiation, like bacterial environmental volume. And it's approved for the measurement of
sepsis
in the ICU, you mentioned. So it has a 94% sensitivity. So the ER guy who missed 6% of bacterial infection did it, a compromised patient, that may be something.
Right.
So how comfortable do you feel that? And B, when you talk about declines, so we're doing some trials about looking at procalcitonin, the people that are really sort of little elevated, some high, some really high, and I don't know if that's genetic or whatever, but
Mm-hmm.
That's a great question. Yeah, absolutely. So here's what I will say in all fairness. You know, Dr. Nowak very appropriately pointed out is there are some people that look pretty sick even with low procalcitonins. And in that circumstance, I still do, you know, what was taught to me in residency, treat the patient, right? I mean, how many times have we seen a monitor that looks like a flat line and where they're ready to do CPR on the patient? And you're like, no, stop, he's still talking. So even when I see a patient with a low procalcitonin, if I'm worried about them getting septic and their lactate's already 4, I'm going to still treat the patient. And if they look crummy, where I am more likely to take a look at is that patient that doesn't look awful and the clinical story isn't too bad, the white count isn't terrible and they don't have it. Where we use it, there isn't any one form of procalcitonin. You ask, how do you see it drop off? It drops off differently for everybody, it seems like. Sometimes there's a nice gentle slope. Sometimes it comes down. That's the great thing is that this is really a test that is so individualized that we can't necessarily say, you know, it's come down by this percentage or we'll expect it to be by this percentage tomorrow. And that's where it is. It's just serial testing. And I would say day-to-day testing because I still work in an OBS unit and we'll check it. They'll get put in the day before. We'll check them the next day in the OBS unit and decide whether or not we're still cool with not giving antibiotics or if it's come down enough, then we'll say, yeah, then I think the antibiotics helped. So I kind of get both sides, but I can't say there's any real smooth, linear distribution of how they come down. Great question, though. Thanks, you appreciate it. Any other questions? All right. Phil Levy is now here.